This episode brought to you by Beta Brand, the San Francisco-based source for crowdfunded clothing you can visit in person the next time you're in San Francisco, or stop by anytime online to shop bestsellers like dress pant yoga pants and now yoga jeans. And when you do, use the code SPIRIT20 to save 20% off anything on the site. But that's not the only reason we love Beta Brand. Oh no, our fandom does not stop at stretchy pants we can wear all day, no matter where we are. There are a great many other things you can do on the site, which is BETABRAND.com. Among them, you can use their Model Citizen tool to upload your own photo and then receive a custom link that makes it look like you are the main model on the homepage of their website. It's kind of a fun thing to share with family and friends on social media, leaving them to wonder whether they should congratulate you on your new and unexpected side gig or actually call your bluff. We're big fans of the company, what they do, and we think you will be too. So check them out at betabrand.com. This and every episode also brought to you with support from Prestope by The Spirit of 608. It's the new, affordable, interactive, and community-driven alternative to traditional PR and media relations built with care by us, especially for fest brands. Visit the site to find out more about how we're able to bring our members one-on-one help and feedback from media experts, including direct answers to your questions, recommended daily media outreach tasks curated by us, especially with your business in mind, a DIY PR resource library, exclusive media ops, and connections with other fest founders, plus much more, all for a monthly cost that's less than what a single hour of professional PR or media consulting would cost your brand. So check it out at prestope.com. That's PRESSDOPE.com. Spirit of 608 bonus episode, Shop Talk. You're listening to the Spirit of 608 podcast. I'm your host, Lorraine Sanders. Keep listening for stories, tips, and advice from women at the forefront of fashion, entrepreneurship, sustainability, and tech. I call it Fest, and it's the future. Hey, and welcome to today's show. Doing something a little bit different over here today. This is going to be a bonus episode all about the Shop Talk conference. And actually, that's not exactly true. It's not all about the Shop Talk conference itself, but it is featuring conversations with people who attended the conference. And with the exception of one interview that we have, everything took place at the conference, which you will become very aware of as you hear the conversations. This is real time, live, honest stuff that we grabbed during the event itself. Conversations we grabbed in the midst of the guests' busy days full of tons of meetings. You'll hear us talking with lots of background noise, and I apologize for the sound quality not being perfect, but I think you're going to get a lot out of these conversations regardless what you hear going on all around us. And I think it gives you a real honest look at what it was like to be there. And I won't say much more because we've got a really long show for you today as it is, but just know we've got four amazing guests from totally different types of companies. I think it's a nice unexpected mix of voices, and I hope it gets your mind going and spurs some new thoughts and leaves you with some takeaway tips that you can put into action as you're thinking about how what you're building right now fits into the larger retail landscape and, of course, the future of fashion. So here we go. Now on to the show. First up, we have a conversation with Margaret Ray of Commerce Tools. Now, we don't often have vendors or companies that are specifically building tools that fest brands would use on the show. In fact, almost every interview that we've had on the show thus far has been a founder or somebody at a very high level inside of a company, you know, with the exception of a couple of VCs and people involved in different accelerator programs. But so this was a really different kind of conversation to have, but it's one that I think is really, really relevant to what many of you are facing and are going to face as as you grow your brands in the coming years. As you'll hear Margaret discuss with me when we sat down to chat at the Shop Talk conference, a lot of what is happening with e-commerce is shifting. And instead of big, gigantic platforms being the way to manage and deploy your products and get them out into the world, things are going into a much more modular direction. Now, I think this stuff is really important and it's interesting and it's a little bit in the weeds, but bear with me because I think it has really interesting implications for companies in the ethical fashion space, because a lot of companies in the ethical fashion space are not dealing with multiples of products in the same way that mainstream traditional brands are. So you have a lot of companies that want to sell secondhand or vintage or one-of-a-kind items or customized items. And there's a lot of challenges that face brands who want to do that nowadays with e-commerce being the way that it is and all that's involved to actually have a product get processed and put onto a website and marketed and sold. And what Margaret is talking about is showing how we're moving towards a different kind of way of doing this in the future, one that has really helped Fest brands already, including one of their clients, the Renewal Workshop, which was actually featured on the Spirit of 628 podcast last year when co-founder Nicole Bassett came on. If you want to learn more about the Renewal Workshop and what they are doing to revamp and repair ethical apparel brands' clothing and then sell it in a secondhand marketplace, you can find that in Spirit of 608, episode 66. Stick around for the end of the chat and you'll hear what it was like for Margaret starting out in the tech industry and being the only woman in the room and how she thinks the industry is changing today. So here we go, Margaret Ray of Commerce Tools. Margaret, welcome to Spirit of 608 podcast.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Yeah, so I'm excited to get to sit and talk with you. And it's kind of cool that we actually found a place to sit after
it
much
nice.
Hunting around at the Shop Talk conference in
Las
Vegas.
It's a busy show. Yes.
It is. And so we're here. You are with Commerce Tools. And I'd love it if you could start us off by telling us a little bit about what the company is and what you do for the brands that you work with.
Thank you. Well, Commerce Tools is a microservices-based cloud commerce platform, but we're what's called a headless commerce platform.
Headless?
I know. It's unpleasant sounding, but once you say it more than once, it's better. So what that means is we don't manage any of the content up front. We only focus on the commerce transaction part at the back end.
Okay.
So product data, information, pricing, that sort of thing. And we work with partners like Adobe and others to build those experiences on the website. And then we just plug in the commerce wherever they want the commerce to be.
Okay. So how is it different from other solutions out there that a brand might use to manage their commerce?
What commerce is doing is evolving the entire commerce architecture. And the way that really helps retailers is they can be much more agile. Many large retailers and even small startup brands are struggling with a really large commerce platform that is inflexible. It's hard to inject commerce, say, into social, into Facebook, for example, because the platform is just very limited in what it can do. And our platform is built on a new architecture called microservices, which allows retailers to be much more nimble and agile. It's almost applying agile marketing philosophy to commerce.
So I feel like, and I'm no expert on this, but I, you know, my sense with the way that e-commerce has evolved in the past 5+ years is that suddenly there have been these big platforms that you can start using in order to run your online shop. And just like you're saying, the idea is that the solution has been a big platform, and what you're saying is now actually maybe it would be better for brands big and small if there was something smaller, like modular, that you could kind of fit into the experience, and then that way you can update what you need to update or manage what you need to manage, but you don't have to
have this big behemoth thing controlling it all. Is that, am I like...
Modular is a perfect word.
Okay.
Because that is the crux of the agility message. So I tell a story about when I worked at Toshiba years ago. And when we were trying to do something with our commerce platform to sell laptops online, we would get into a conference room. 90% of the people in the conference room were from the IT department, and the others were in marketing. And it's starting to shift now, where you need to have a large digital marketing team and a commerce team, because they know, what are my customer targets? What are the analytics telling me about buyer behavior? And less reliance on IT to implement the changes you need to implement. So that room is going to shift. And that's what we're talking about with Commerce Tools, is you shouldn't need to rely so much on IT to make the changes you need to make, because it takes a lot longer.
So I know that you've done work with a company that has come on the Spirit of 608 podcast. We had Nicole Bassett of the Renewal Workshop come on last year, and a lot of people really just raved about her story and the show that she was in. Can you, just to illustrate for people listening, how one might work with Commerce Tools, tell us a little bit about what you've done with the Renewal Workshop and what you've brought to them that really helped solve a problem.
Right. Renewal Workshop is a great story, not just because they're finding a way to reinvent fashion and to not have so much go into the landfill, so much waste, if product has mild damage in manufacturing. So, but imagine a virtual product catalog. That's essentially what you have, because it keeps changing. Mm-hmm. They might get a shipment of Patagonia jackets in that need zipper replacements, and now suddenly need to get those on your website pretty quickly to move that inventory out. There are very few platforms that have that level of flexibility in setting up those really custom and one-time SKUs. And that's probably the biggest help, the biggest feature that helped Renewal Workshop do what they're doing.
I think it's so interesting, the implications of that for not only what a company like the Renewal Workshop is doing, but also just for secondhand or consignment, or, you know, things that are individual, like that, you know, aren't just mass produced. And so it's really that it's interesting stuff, because I think that's been a huge barrier to companies that are selling that way to growing, because they just can't manage the process of getting that stuff updated.
Absolutely, especially with the e-commerce element, because if you think about, you know, your e-commerce is able to sell a much, much broader range of products, but at the same time, if you're in more of a custom type product building scenario, you need that flexibility. We're talking to another customer right now that is a custom clothing manufacturer. So now suddenly they're setting up different sizes and lengths and colors and patterns that are pretty custom designs for their customers. They're going to sell those online. So it's another example of, you know, more directed fashion, I think, more specific creations for fashion that you can sell instantly.
Well, it's very cool stuff. Thank you for telling us about Commerce Tools and what you're working on. I'd love to get a little bit about how you got here and your background. I mean, you mentioned Toshiba. You know, what were you doing before Commerce Tools?
So I've been in high tech actually my entire professional career, really. I stumbled into high tech accidentally. I don't think it was my intention, but I happened to start in a very technical software company. I started in a very technical software company in Silicon Valley years ago, and I was in product management, and I was the only female, and I was the only female for many, many years. I didn't really notice it, though, because I don't see the male versus female. I see skill sets, and I see complementary functions within an organization, so I never really thought about it. But many people pointed it out to me that, hey, you're the only female in this meeting. And Does that make you uncomfortable? And I said, no, not really. But things have changed, and I'm so happy to see more women in tech. And I think the emergence of marketing technology has allowed women to get more into tech, because we can now use our marketing skills and our marketing backgrounds and blend that in with technology, what consumers are looking for and what kind of tools we can use. It's really a fascinating place. Before Commerce Tools, I actually worked at another commerce company, but I've been with Toshiba. I worked at Intel for years, so I've seen a lot of changes in the market.
So, given your experience and, you know, the fact that a lot of our listeners are women who are either working in tech-based companies or hoping to start one of their own, often with a stylish twist to it, what advice would you have for them as they're coming up the ranks these days with all of the talk that's out there about women in tech? And, you know, people, I think a lot of times they argue, we don't want to talk about women in tech anymore, it's irritating, and then other people, that's all they want to talk about. Do you have any thoughts about what a woman could do to navigate this stuff? And actually, I kind of want to stop and say, I don't want to ask you a question that I wouldn't ask a guy. So just in terms of career advice in general, for someone who's really trying to make things happen for themselves, are there things that you've done that have really, looking back, you think were key to you being able to have the career that you've had?
Absolutely. And this is going to sound really cliche, but it truly is, do what you love. Find your passion. Even if you think your job is small, or if you think your company isn't big in the industry, if you love what you're doing or a piece of what you're doing, keep on doing that. And the rest will come. The rest you can manage. But it's really to find people in your professional network that do the same thing that you do, or that do complementary things that you do. And I have a large network of friends that we lift each other up, because I'm passionate about this one piece and they might be passionate about that one piece, and you can build a much bigger thing for yourself that way.
Cool. Well, thank you for telling us a little bit about what you do and giving us that advice. And yeah, I'm glad we've gotten a chance to sit down and talk.
Yes, thank you very much. It was fun.
And just to close out, if people want to find Commerce Tools online or keep up with you on social media, what's the best way for them to track you down digitally?
I would go commercetools.com is our company website. I'm actually at Soiree on Twitter.
That's just my... You have just the word Soiree?
Soiree.
You had to get in there early to get that.
I did. It's my...
It's pretty awesome.
It's, yeah, it's my fun little handle.
Awesome.
On Twitter, so follow me there.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Next, we're moving from a conversation with Commerce Tools to a chat with a startup founder. So a very different type of conversation. You'll hear from Elisa Rossi of Rossi and Ray, a San Francisco-based luxury brand focused on creating a pre-order model for luxury Italian-made goods. And I was excited to bring Elisa into the conversation for many reasons. I loved getting to know her at the conference, and also have been thrilled to work with her through Press Dope by Spirit of 608. But beyond the fact that I think she's just a really interesting, cool woman with a lot of smart things to say, I wanted to bring the perspective of a brand and a founder who is considering a conference and attending a conference, like a big one like Shop Talk, when in the pre-launch phase for her business and her brand. You know, as you'll hear her say, they're working towards launch later this year. And I know a lot of founders in this type of situation at this stage of business, they'll wonder, well, should I attend conferences, or what are industry events really going to do for me? And I think Elisa has a really great take on that. And you're going to get a window into one founder's experience with this kind of thing, and a real take on what she got out of it. Also, she brings into the conversation something that I think we all love when we attend industry events and panels, and, you know, whether it's a big conference or just something that you go to on a weeknight where you hear local experts talking, it's honest conversation, things that are not just safe and canned and part of your brand's messaging. You know, she brings up a moment where a founder that I think many of you listening are going to recognize when you hear Elisa tell the story, but this founder openly disagreed with several other people on the panel and went ahead and said what she really thought. And that's something that I know so many of us would like to see more of at industry events. So it was great to have that come into the conversation and talk about it for a little bit. Stick around for Elisa's advice on getting the most out of a conference experience, from doing your homework before you go to approaching speakers and setting up meetings during the events itself, and also staying focused, because there's always so much more than you can actually take in when you go to a multi-day event. A quick note, we did record this a couple of days after the conference. We had a great time hanging out there. Because of our busy schedules, it made much more sense for us just to talk once we were grounded back at home. So here we go. Elisa Rossi of Rossi and Ray. Elisa, welcome to the Spirit of 608 podcast.
Hi, Lorraine. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. So to start off, can you tell us the name of your company and what it is? What are you working on at the moment?
Yeah. So the name of my company is Rossi and Ray. We haven't launched officially yet, but Rossi and Ray is going to be a modern luxury brand. We're going to be selling bespoke artisanal goods. Think hats, handbags, scarves, knitwear that can be pre-ordered directly from Italian artisans. And so our mission is, you know, to democratize that white glove experience of commissioning a bespoke luxury product in an artisan workshop. And that's what we've been working toward. It's been a very long time in the making, all of my life, in fact. I left Italy when I was, you know, in college because I wanted to learn English and acquire business skills to be able to help the artisans in my hometown grow their business internationally. And so I studied Russian, English, Spanish, and I came to the United States as an exchange student. But 13 years later, I was still in the US and I was working in technology, leading a very hectic lifestyle and doing everything but what I've always wanted to do. So I decided to start doing something about it and get back to my original calling. And, you know, I didn't know what I want to be doing exactly at first. So I just started importing some luxury goods from my favorite artisans in Italy. And I started selling them at events, at trunk shows, street markets, etc. And a year and a half later, the idea for Rossi and Ray had solidified, and now I've been working on it full time since the beginning of the year and targeting an August, September launch date.
Yeah, and it's so interesting because you are coming to this, but it's after having a decade long or more career in the tech space in the San Francisco Bay Area. And, you know, I don't know, it's not every day that I run into somebody that's sort of shifted gears like this and gone from, you know, what you described it as a very nice tech lifestyle. And now you're moving into this entirely different thing that has a much more like social mission, and it ties into your childhood and everything that were like values that you had growing up. So I loved getting to know more about that, from getting to know more about you, both talking to you a little bit before the Shop Talk conference, and then also there where we got a chance to hang out and talk quite a bit about what you have in the works.
Yeah, I mean, technology just happened for me. You know, I didn't come here to look for a tech job in the Silicon Valley. You know, I just came here as an exchange student to study at UC Berkeley and learn English, because my English was pretty bad when I came here. I wanted to go back to Italy. I wanted to work for Italian artisans. But then, you know, in the Silicon Valley, it was 2004. The job market was extremely hot here, much hotter than Italy anyway. And so, you know, I got a job at Apple, which, you know, was kind of unexpected for me. And, you know, I felt like this small town girl, you know, catapulted into this thing that was bigger than myself. And, you know, 13 years later, I was still working in tech. I worked at Apple for a while, and then I worked at a number of startups in San Francisco.
Okay, so these days, even though you've had this tech background, you're an early stage entrepreneur in your new company that will be launching later this year. So what brought you to the conference? Why come out there and spend the time and, you know, make the investment to show up?
Yeah, well, you know, I think especially as you venture out on an entrepreneurial adventure on your own, it's important to, you know, stay up to date on what's happening out there in the industry. I am a solo founder. In fact, I have another team member, but he's in Italy. So it's very easy to isolate yourself when you're working so hard on getting your own business off the ground. And Shop Talk was, you know, the perfect opportunity for me at the perfect time, because I'd been working on this for a couple of months. And, you know, I had all of these things in my mind and I was reading so many things online, but I really needed to get out there and I needed to talk to people who are experts in the industry. And, you know, Shop Talk did literally all of that for me. I got to talk to potential investors. I got to talk to people that are, you know, the best of the best in what they do in e-commerce and retail in the industry. So it was a fantastic opportunity.
Well, and so we've talked about how, I mean, it was a huge, I'm going to call it a mega conference. I mean, it was huge. It was like 5,000 people. And, you know, there were so many different things going on. You could have spent your entire day just in the trade show space itself or having meetings with people. And we talked a little bit about the importance of kind of focusing on one thing that you're really hoping to get out of it. And I know that for you, you spent a lot of time focused on the pre-order model because that's part of what you're creating. And then also personalization, because that's going to be a key part of your line going forward. So when you were listening to people with those things in mind and trying to learn how they think about pre-order and personalization, did you have any big like takeaways or aha moments or things during the show that you heard from the panels and the speakers that are going to affect how you do business going forward?
Oh, yeah. I mean, not so much on the pre-order side of things, but there was a whole track entirely dedicated to personalization and customization. So I completely focused on that. And I try to meet most of the people who were speaking at those panels. There was one panel, especially with Michelle Lam of True & Co. and two other guys. I don't remember their names, but they have their own custom clothing brands where people can submit a design or design online. And it was extremely interesting because she was actually questioning the size of the market for customization, you know, which was refreshing to hear a panelist actually, you know, adopt a contrarian view at these conferences. You know, it was refreshing because it sparked an amazing conversation about content creators versus simple consumers, right? And Michelle Lam believes that the market of content creators is too small and that attracting simple consumer through personalized content, rather than giving them the ability to build something from scratch, will always prevail. And so it was a conversation about the importance of knowing your audience. And there was, you know, a subtle jab about e-commerce trends that seem to be popping out every year and that sometimes aren't as big a trend as one would believe. Attended these conferences. And, you know, I kind of like managed to form my own opinion by the end of the panel, which was very helpful for me as a business in who's kind of getting into personalization. And I think that there's definitely a massive audience of content creators and influencers out there, like waiting to be unleashed and always going to set the tone and influence the conversation. So having them on your platform is incredibly valuable. But I also do believe that there needs to be a healthy balance between personalization and customization. And, you know, and that's going to be a challenge that I identified at this conference for my company to solve, to tackle for our customers.
Okay, so to break this down for people that may not be as well-versed in customization and personalization and how that works with an e-commerce-based business, are you talking about how you could have influencers come on and really create a product from scratch and you need somebody, for somebody to be able to do that, they really need to be invested as a content creator in your platform versus somebody that would just come and tweak a few things that on a pre-existing item and sort of make it their own and then purchase it at that point? Is that kind of the delineation between the two?
Absolutely. And I mean, yeah, personalization doesn't necessarily involve creating something or even selecting items that will be added onto your product. Personalization is just being served content that is relevant to you, right? That's personalized for you, whatever that is. So it could be a finished product. But if I go to a website and I see a selection of those products that's really relevant to me, that's personalization. Whereas customization is here it is, like, you know, a blank piece of paper, go in and design something and we'll build it for you and we'll ship it to you.
Yeah, see, that stuff has always struck me as really cool sounding. But then as a consumer, when someone gives me the opportunity to truly build something from scratch, I'm often a little bit hesitant to do it because I'm not sure if I can create something that looks as good as the professionals. Like I've had people say, here's a tool that you could use to build your own handbag, for example. And I've tried and like shoes and they always end up looking really bad. And I don't know if like that's just me or, you know, it's hard. It's not easy. Is that a challenge that you were hearing come up in this panel? Is that kind of what Michelle Lam was challenging the panelists on?
Yep, exactly. You know, she was like, how many content creators are out there? You know, like there's only a limited amount of people that are into that and who are, you know, excited about creating their own products. But, you know, that goes back to the point of know your audience, you know, because there's a bunch of content creators and that's exactly what they're into. They want to be feel unique. They want to create something. And then there's the people that absolutely aren't at all into creation. And then there's everyone in between. So knowing where you fall in that spectrum as a company and what options you want to offer your customer is extremely important to nail down at an early stage, because it's going to have an impact on what type of customers you're going after.
Okay, that's fascinating stuff. I did not see that panel and now I wish I had. You're giving me like FOMO, post-conference FOMO. So, well, so you spent 3 days there. Like, what do you have a favorite moment of the conference or something that really sticks out to you as really a highlight for you?
It wasn't any specific moment. I must say that my most favorite part of the conference was the ability to just meet amazing people. Just I turn around and I meet someone who was the VP of digital at, you know, this large luxury brand. And then I, you know, I'm sitting at a table having a snack with other people. And one of them was, you know, I mean, everyone was the best in their field in the United States and probably globally. And so just to be able to strike up conversations with people that are so interesting and everything they do and they know was just incredible. I would say, yeah, it just doesn't happen every day.
Yeah, no, I agree. I had the same kind of feelings throughout the experience. And that's really the highlight of going to a conference. But on the flip side, they are time consuming and they can be, you know, there's so much going on and it can be, you know, hard sometimes to get the most out of it or stay focused during an event like that. Based on your recent experience, do you have any advice for other founders heading out to big events later this year? Anything you would tell somebody like you to do or not to do to get the best return on their time / money investment, whichever it is, as they're going?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I would say do your own work, right? On the agenda, the speakers, who's out there, what are the tracks? And, you know, try to tune out everything that's not relevant to you, because there's way more than anyone can handle. So I try to keep it, you know, there was a lot of conversation about AI, you know, and retail innovation and a bunch of other trends that are super relevant right now in retail and e-commerce. And I try to tune out the things that weren't relevant to me as much as I could. And then I researched speakers, because a lot of the speakers were people I actually wanted to meet. And so I wanted to figure out where they were, which panels were they were moderating so that I could go and talk to them afterwards. And by doing that, I think I met the people I wanted to meet and extracted the maximum amount of value out of the conference.
Did you have luck going up to people after the panels and meeting with them, people who've been on the stage?
Yes, absolutely.
I didn't actually try that because I'm so, you know, I like have my media. I don't know what it is. It's kind of almost like a media crutch where I tend to, you know, have these appointments with people through PR. And then when I get to the end of their panel or something, I'm like, oh, I'll just, you know, connect with them at another time. But actually, I think going up to them afterwards is far, far better to do. And I was wondering if they had made the speakers accessible this year to people, because I know last year they had sort of shuffled people through a door after their speaking engagement and it wasn't as easy to connect with them. So it sounds like that might have changed this year.
No, absolutely. It depended on the panel. But like there were other instances where I just reached out to them over LinkedIn. Isn't that crazy? And they responded. And we met while we were at the conference, because then, you know, you have that advantage of being in the same location.
Yeah.
And so it's easier to meet. And if you make a LinkedIn, if you send a LinkedIn email that's extremely specific to that event, like meet later, I'm at Shop Talk, I'm doing this, I would love to talk to you. They actually were more responsive. And, you know, I had a couple of breakfasts out of that were extremely helpful. So don't be shy, you know, just go for it. You have nothing to lose. You're there. You're in the same location as a bunch of people. Why not?
Wonderful advice. Anything else you'd like to share with listeners of The Spirit of 608 so they have it in mind as you're working towards your launch later this year?
Yeah. Well, about Shop Talk specifically or?
No, about you, your brand, about Rossi and Ray.
About Rossi and Ray. Well, you know, I'm in a launch in planning mode right now. So it's a phase that for a startup can actually be a bit terrifying, as all of you know. And then thank you, Lorraine, for kind of helping me think through what needs to happen over the next few months. yeah, I guess that's where I am right now. I have products ready to go, but I'm still figuring out exactly the go-to-market strategy, because the more I talk to people and the more I hear sometimes conflicting advice on how to do it, they say, you know, if you want to position as a luxury brand, you should start offline. Or a lot of other people say, yeah, but you're still a startup, so you definitely benefit from the exposure to the online world. And, you know, it's a hard decision to make. And I think the best thing I can do right now, and the thing that's actually been helping me the most stay grounded, is to do small tests and, you know, see how people react to our products, putting my messaging and my products out there and try to get early reactions of people, and then use those insights to document a broader launch plan.
So if people want to keep up with you and all the good things you have coming out this year, what's the best way for them to find you online? And do you have a social media platform that you'd want them to go to connect?
Definitely. We are on Instagram at Rossi_Rei, R-E-I. And you can also email me. It's E-L-I-S-A, Elisa, at Rossi-Rei.com.
Wonderful. Well, thank you for talking a little bit more about your experience at Shop Talk. And, you know, I know listeners are going to get a lot out of your insights. And yeah. We'll see you on Instagram.
Thank you, Lorraine.
Next up, I sat down with Andrew Gonzalez of Olapic. That's OLAPIC.com. And what they do, it's really interesting. They work with major brands, also emerging brands, and they help those companies find and harness and use the power of their user-generated content. Okay, so what does that mean? They have a lot of ways of working with different companies depending on their size. And they really, on a simple level, are in the business of streamlining that process that many of you have no doubt invested a ton of time into, where you're going and you're trying to find all of the mentions that are being made of your brand. You know, the images that are out on different social media platforms, the ways that customers are interacting with your products and sharing them with their friends. They are in the business of going out and helping brands gather all that content, figure out what's going to be the best pieces of that content from the mass sea of things that are out there, the best ones, and then how to reuse that so that it in turn drives more engagement and sales and, you know, whatever the brand's goal is. And the fascinating thing is, you know, they've worked with major household name brands, Bumble and Bumble, The Body Shop, All Saints, Calvin Klein, The North Face. I mean, the list goes on. And what they find time and time again is that this kind of user generated content outperforms brand creative or advertising. It outperforms images manufactured inside the brand to promote the brand when you actually are showing images created by the real people that are fans of the brand and are buying its products and are in its, you know, wider, real, like really existing in the real world community. So I find that to be really fascinating. One of the reasons I wanted to have, you know, a conversation with Andrew and get Olapic onto the show is that, you know, we talk a lot about earned media in Spirit of 608 land and then also inside of Prestope, which some of you are also a part of. And that conversation about earned media is typically, we're talking about getting press coverage and media mentions. But the user-generated content realm is also part of that earned media conversation. And so I thought it would be cool to bring in a completely different side of the earned media conversation so that you can, as you're moving forward with what you're building and your plans to amplify your brand this year, you can think about the power of those images that people in your audience may be creating, whether you are somebody that's got a 200 person following on Instagram or whether you've got millions. All of this stuff is ultra relevant to the project of growing a brand today. And Olapic has a really interesting perspective to bring to that conversation because of the work that they do with so many of the brands that are really killing it on social media today. So I hope that you take that away from the conversation. And I hope you enjoy the fact that we were sitting in a hallway while doing this, like on the ground. We were in a hallway. Shop Talk, the conference, has grown and exploded so much in the past year. I mean, it was like 80%. Higher attendee number this year than last. And so we literally had to take matters into our own hands to escape to a quieter spot to record because there was so much festivity going on in the rest of the show, which made it a really fun one to attend. And I mentioned that A, because I think it's funny, and B, because there's some things in the background that you will hear that affected the sound quality of the conversation a little bit. But just bear with us. You know, we're trying to make it work. And now on to the chat with Andrew of Olapic.
Andrew, welcome to the Spirit of 608 podcast.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, so can you start us off by telling us a little bit about what Olapik is and what it does.
Yeah, definitely. Olapik is what we're calling a visual content marketing platform. And basically, it's a SaaS platform that allows brands to connect with their engaged communities who are creating visual content on social platforms like Instagram and Twitter and Pinterest.
So you're talking about brands that have significant followings and their fans are out there just on their own, or maybe because they're trying to participate with the brand in some way, prompted by hashtags, like they're generating pictures and that's what you're capturing and bringing to them.
That's exactly right. So the best fit kind of brands for us are brands that are already engaged with a large sort of participating community, or brands that are interested in sort of building that engaged community. So we really do rely on that organic sort of brand participation, people who love your brand and they're out there creating content already.
Yeah, it's interesting because there's a lot of solutions and you know, companies out there focused on helping brands figure out how to generate that kind of content or encourage their users. But it sounds like you're going in and providing a solution for people that they're like, we have all this content, exactly, but what are we going to do with it now? So on that note, what do you help the brands do with all of that content once they've seen it out there coming in from people in their audiences?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really interesting concept. So you're right. A lot of solutions are focused on helping you generate a following. And we kind of tap into the natural, I hate to say it, but like organic participation that's happening out there already, right? You probably hear that a lot. And the problems that we're solving are a couple. From a pretty broad level, brands have lots of channels that they need to connect to their consumers in. And those channels are increasingly visual. And channels means, your Instagram handle, your Pinterest board, your digital display ad buys, your email marketing, even your website. And so from that aspect, we're simply helping brands sort of bridge the gap between the demand for visual content that they have to fill all these channels and sort of the supply side, where it's expensive and slow to like professionally create all the content yourself, and stock photography is boring and inauthentic, doesn't connect with people, right? And from a more commerce-focused point of view, our hypothesis many years ago when we were deploying this technology first into e-commerce was that this user-generated content, these images of people wearing and using and loving your products, would help you sell more stuff online. Sort of where text reviews and five-star reviews were the user-generated product review of the past, we saw visuals being shared on Instagram as like a photo product review, user-generated photo review.
Okay, well, so that all makes sense. When it comes to connecting the brands with that content, what happens to it then? Like, how do they put these images and thing that are a more authentic way to communicate with their audience and sell their products? Like, how do you guys actually help them connect to the products and sell more?
Yeah, totally. So Olapik positions itself as what we call a content engine, right? So imagine a hub at the center of like a content strategy. One side of our tool is the collection side, where brands come into our platform and through a number of sort of mechanisms, they start to hook content and pull it into the system, into the platform. So mostly it's through sort of branded hashtags. Brands that we work with like Adidas and J.Crew use hashtag MyJCrew to collect content from. It's also through influencers, so you can follow user handles to collect content. And we've got some location collection mechanisms as well. That's kind of on the collection side. And then everything goes into a pretty intuitive moderation queue. So the stuff that comes in goes through a few layers of computer vision sort of analysis and filtering. But at the end of the day, a human, somebody from the brand or somebody from Olapik, we've got a pretty sizable moderation team, actually looks at this content to determine whether it meets sort of the brand guidelines. And then we, in that moderation workflow, we also tag it to products. So tag it to your product inventory that you sell online.
Okay. So talk to me a little bit about this new thing that you're coming out with and telling people about at Shop Talk, since that's where we are, sitting in a hallway.
Yeah,
where if anybody listening can hear all of the, we decided to sneak into the catering hallway to try to escape.
This was my bad idea.
No. But I mean, there's like 5,000 people here this year or something. I mean, they say that there's 80% more people. So
really?
It's crazy. And I'm not surprised we had to, yeah.
We're gonna camp out.
Yeah.
Okay. So one of the big trends, we were talking about trends sort of to set this conversation up, right? And one of the things that we're seeing is this concept of like distributed commerce. And what that means is moving the shopping cart to different points in the customer sort of engagement journey.
And do you mean, so by that you mean instead of somebody always needing to locate the shopping cart in one particular place of the website, you're trying to make it so they essentially can get there from almost wherever they are.
Yeah, from any touch point. So instead of the traditional, like, come to the home page, go to a category page, find a product I like, end up on the product page, and then add it to bag from there, we've developed this new product called Inspire, which basically takes a transparent overlay of shoppable hotspots, places that on top of any image anywhere on your site, and, you know, think about using that really high polish hero imagery that's at the header of your, you know, homepage, and putting shoppable overlays on top of it and allowing me to add it directly to my bag from that image without having to go two clicks down into a product page.
Now, does that only work on, I mean, is it something that only works on the site, or is the idea that you could also say do that in your email marketing campaigns and other places where you're reaching your customer?
Yeah. So first iteration of this, what we're previewing here, is on-site only. But obviously the future is to distribute this sort of shopping cart experience anywhere. Make it flexible. Take it with you.
Okay. So from what you're seeing, is this something that you feel retailers are going to need to be able to adapt and do? This whole idea of the shopping cart kind of moving around and being sort of like a modular thing that people can reach anywhere. Is this something they're going to need to do to compete in the future?
Yeah, I think it's critical. I mean, first of all, it's a great opportunity, right? But eventually it's going to become the sort of norm. Shoppers, consumers are going to want to be able to like action their inspiration from anywhere. And you see it already with platforms, you know, that we're closely affiliated with, like Instagram is bringing shopping experience to their native app. And that's sort of a taste of the future. If I'm a consumer, I'm going to want to be able to take action on, you know, my desire to purchase and ship something to my apartment anywhere I encounter that image.
And so let's talk a little bit about the types of brands you work with. I know you work with some really huge companies, massive brands that are household names. Do you work with smaller brands? Because a lot of the people who listen to this show are fashion startups and, you know, independent labels.
Yeah, no, totally. So Olaplex wouldn't be around if it weren't for some of the early moving fashion startups that were willing to sign up with us many years ago, right? So as we've grown, you know, the scale of our customer has grown as well. And you're right, we do tap into sort of the enterprise end of the market to a good extent. But our tools and our pricing structure is geared to enable us to continue working with these, you know, you call them fashion startups, emerging brands, whatever they are. And that's really interesting for us because they're the ones who are typically willing to experiment with new things first, try it, see if it works, see if it doesn't work. And that relationship and sort of feedback loop has been really critical to our success.
So when you're looking at brands that are really doing a good job of communicating and reaching their audience wherever they are, you know, using this user-generated content in the best possible way, are there any things you can say about what they're doing and how they're communicating with people that no matter what size brand you are, you could benefit from hearing about?
Yeah, definitely. Olaplex is a content platform, right? So from a content point of view, what we're seeing is it's really critical to sort of look and feel and sound like the person you're targeting in the medium that you're targeting them in, right? So that's why it's really interesting to collect content from your community on Instagram and then reuse that asset in a social channel, because that's like a native social asset, right? So really critical that you're sort of nailing the, you know, the voice, the authentic voice and look and feel of the consumer in the channel where you're communicating with them.
All right, so you're kind of saying like you need to speak the language of the person you're trying to reach, and this is a way of doing that visually.
You know, it's actually interesting. With the smaller brands, it may be a little different, but some of the psychology that we see that deploys, you know, into advertising and branding is that consumers trust brands the least. You know, they trust their friends, then they trust total strangers, and then they trust brand voice. With some of these really keyed in sort of emerging brands, might not be the case all the time. You know, they've got like a pretty authentic, direct connection to their community. But what we're seeing is the ability to tap into the community makes that communication like really seamless and feel really authentic.
All right, cool. Well, so I always ask people who come on the show how they got to where they are. What were you doing before working with Olapik? How did you get into this type of job?
Interesting. This is a surprise. You didn't prep me for this question.
Well, I mean, can you answer?
I can't.
I feel like it's pretty like
it's autobiographical.
Yeah, you know the information, right?
So I was a lawyer before I ended up at this, what was then a little 10-person startup in the Lower East Side of New York. I was a lawyer. I knew I wanted to work in tech. I had done an internship at a big tech company in the Bay Area, but wanted to get right back into it. And I'm like kind of a guy who looks for shortcuts. So I moved to New York and found this little startup that had a job posting for a marketing manager, which means that they didn't really know what they were looking for. They just needed people to put butts in seats and do stuff. And that's how it all started about 5 years ago. And since then, I've done a bunch of things inside the company.
Okay, so you've been with them for the entire time.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool. All right. Well, is there anything else that you think listeners should know about Olapik that we have not already touched on?
Yeah, we've been talking about kind of our core e-com platform and our core offering and user-generated content sort of heavy. I'd encourage you guys to come check out some of our other offerings because we're doing interesting stuff with not just earned user-generated content, but we're doing some interesting things with brands' own content as well. So kind of turning our content engine into a place to house all of your visual assets and sort of be able to flexibly distribute them throughout all of your marketing channels.
So you mean you're giving them a place to actually, it's like a tool to keep all of that stuff organized and to be able to deploy it to who you want to get it to and when and all that.
100%.
Okay, cool. So if people want to keep up with Olapik and all the great stuff you guys have coming out this year, what's the best way for them to follow along online?
So olapik.com and our blog page that gets updated multiple times a week. And if they've got questions, they can email me, andrew@olapik.com.
And I'm dying to know, what's y'all's favorite social channel? I mean, you deal with all of them, but do you have one that is the biggest for Olapik itself?
From a platform point of view?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's definitely Instagram.
All right, cool. Well, thank you for chatting, and hope you have a great rest of your time at Shop Talk.
Yeah, Lauren, enjoy Las Vegas.
Now for our fourth and final conversation in our special Shop Talk bonus episode. I can't think of a better guest to close out everything we've talked about than Mickey Berardelli. She's the CEO of Kidbox. It's a retail platform that offers curated selections of clothes for babies on up through teen sizes. You can order a box, keep everything in it, keep some pieces, send the rest back. You can think of it very much like a Stitch Fix for baby and children and teen clothing. Now, I was excited to get Mickey on the show and interview her for a variety of different reasons. One, I'm very excited about the future of box commerce. I'm curious what's happening in that realm. The company has a really cool philanthropic element to what they do. You'll hear Mickey talk about that. And then also, probably most importantly, is Mickey herself. She has had a storied, accomplished, impactful career in retail. And whenever I have the opportunity to bring somebody like her on the show, I jump at the chance. Prior to joining Kidbox as the CEO of that company last fall, she was president of digital commerce and chief marketing officer for Chico's brands, including Chico's White House Black Market and Soma Intimates. Before that, she was at Tory Burch as the chief marketing officer. She has also worked for Ralph Lauren Limited 2 and a number of other brands and received a ton of different accolades. You'll hear me kind of botch her accolades as I'm talking to her. We were in a hallway. You can't, you know, give me a break here. But she has been named top women in cross-channel retail, top 50 women brand marketers, top 10 of tomorrow. I mean, the list goes on and on. And so I really wanted to bring her perspective to you because I know many of you are inspired by and motivated by women like Mickey. Pay attention to what she has to say about hiring leaders early on in the life of your company and how that can help create the right company culture down the line. And also, the one thing, according to Mickey, that matters more than anything else when it comes to the day-to-day enjoyment of your job. Now, I briefly mentioned the hallway again. Full disclosure, in the middle of our conversation, you will hear the sound shift because we got kicked out of the hallway. Yes, we had to relocate in the middle of the interview. And, you know, we're not fancy here. We're just trying to get things done and get good conversations in your ears to help you with all that you're working on building and growing. And so we moved in the middle of it and you will hear the sound shift a little bit. So thank you so much for bearing with us during this less than perfect audio experience throughout this episode. And I know you're going to get a lot of what she has to say regardless of the background noise, but apologies for that. And thanks for hanging in with us. Now on to the conversation with Mickey Berardelli of Kidbox.
Mickey, welcome to the Spirit of 608 podcast.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Yeah, I'm excited to get to talk to you. How's your Shop Talk experience going so far?
It's been going really well. I can't believe the growth just since, you know, last year was their first year and this is the second year and it almost doubled in size in terms of attendance.
So. It's crazy. And
it really is.
You can certainly see it in the halls too. I mean, it's been buzzing just every single day. Well, so can you start us out and tell us a little bit about Kidbox, what it is and how you're different from other clothing retailers that sell apparel for kids?
Yeah, so Kidbox is essentially, I guess you could think of it at like Trunk Club or Stitch Fix for children. However, we are very differentiated in many ways. We are not technically a subscription service. We're opt-in, opt-out as you go. We don't feel that we want to rope parents into a subscription, and they may choose to have a spring box, but not a summer box. It's all based on their needs, and then come back to us for back to school. So we really wanted the consumer to be in the driver's seat of selecting what boxes. With that said, we have many customers who just have asked us to just be subscription. I just want to opt in for all 5 seasonal boxes for the year. So we're in the process of really figuring out how we want to handle that. But essentially what Kidbox is parent and the child go on to kidbox.com or our mobile site or our app, and they go through the style profile experience, the gender of the child, the age of the child, the sizes that they wear on top and bottom, things about their style preferences and personality, and what makes them unique. And all of those answers to those questions feed into a proprietary algorithm that we actually hit up against our product catalog at the moment. And that algorithm assembles the perfect box for a 7-year-old sporty boy, for example, to our styling team. And then the styling team goes into that box assortment and may tweak it a little bit, or it may be okay, and they bless it from a styling human perspective, and the box is sent out. We carry many premier brands, well-known brands like Lucky, Seven, Kenzie, Roxy, Diesel, Reebok, Puma, so many brands across a lot of different style personality sensibilities, and we assemble about 6 to 7 items per box, and it's personally curated for the customer, as I mentioned. The box arrives addressed to the child. So children, even in today's day and age of technology and smartphones, they still love getting mail and they love the anticipation of waiting for something coming through the mail. And 6 to 7 items per box, they don't pay for anything until they have the opportunity to see the items and try them on at home. And it's free returns, free exchanges. And if they keep the entire box, it's $98, which is amazing pricing for those brands.
Oh, wow. So it's a flat price per box.
Price for the full kept box. And then the real important part of our mission is the social mission, which is for every box kept, we partner with an organization known as KIDS Fashion Delivers to clothe a child in need. So pillars of the brand are premier brands, amazing prices. The third pillar is threefold. It's convenience for the mom, fun for the child, and time together for both of them. And the fourth is our social mission, the importance of giving back.
Yeah, well, I thought it was really interesting. You know, a lot of brands these days have a social mission, but if you go to your website, just kidbox.com, you will see that mission and that the feature of you giving back is actually right there on the homepage. At least at the moment, it's like the top thing on the page, which is not, I mean, it stands out to me because it's not often the case. A lot of times you see the philanthropic mission down at the footer of a website. So I thought that really spoke to the importance of that in what you're trying to do.
When the company was founded, there was a big focus on that being core to the brand and to the business and to the culture of the company that we're building and the team that we're assembling at Kidbox. And the most powerful thing that we're hearing from our customers, and this was sort of a surprise for us, shouldn't have been, but it's been a really powerful thing to hear back from customers, is that they're having the conversation about the importance of giving back with their children earlier in their life than they would have otherwise because of the Kidbox shopping experience. So we look at that and we think that's pretty powerful.
So I'm a parent, I get a box, I can pick it whenever I want, it comes to me, and I can keep what I want, send the rest back. If I keep it all, it's $98. Otherwise, it's per item, sort of a la carte.
A la carte pricing.
Okay. All right, cool. So that's how it works. And can we talk a little bit about just the whole box concept in general? Because I feel like at Shop Talk especially, you know, we've been hearing a lot about it. There's a lot of companies that are either doing that as their core way to reach the customer, or they're incorporating that into what they already do. And it's really starting to feel to me kind of like way a million years ago, back in the day, everyone sort of like talked about having a blog, and now it's almost not even talked about because it's just you have this way to communicate with people, and that's what you do. Do you think boxes are going to become sort of this de facto way of reaching a customer? Is that where we're headed, or do you see them staying in their own category?
I do see them as an important category in this chapter of retail, but anyone who's been in retail the last 10 to 15 years, it's changing so rapidly that I can't predict that they'll be around forever. And I think the idea of a box might evolve as well. I think there will probably be new creative ways to serve as, you know, come up with new vehicles or capsules for product. But what the box movement represents right now in the industry to me and in the consumer landscape is this idea of time is a luxury today. And especially moms, especially our parents of the Kidbox children consumer, they don't have the time that it requires to go and pick out items that their children would love. So I think boxes, whether it's for pets or for food or for apparel, it's the idea of this curation. It's the idea of this personal styling and this taking it, putting it into somebody else's hands as a service for you. And I don't think that idea will change anytime soon. I think that's the essence of what the box movement represents, and that will continue to gain traction in the industry, I believe.
So that idea of just having more sort of almost more targeted options for people and products getting right into the recipient's hands and them not having to do as much picking and choosing through the vast array of stuff that we have in front of us.
Right. I think in the case of, you know, some of the pet boxes, it's this idea of having these merchants who know where to find this cool product that you might not be able to find at your go-to pet store. So it's this idea of being able to put it into their hands to find the coolest stuff for your pet. In the apparel industry, a lot of people don't know how to style themselves or don't know how to shop efficiently. And so in apparel, it lends itself to personal style and efficiency, shopping.
Okay, well, I'd love to switch gears for a second. And we've heard about Kidbox, but I want to talk a little bit about you. You've had a really storied career. You've had a lot of interesting things that you've done, and you've been named all kinds of, you've gotten a lot of accolades. So you've been named to the top 50 women brand marketers. You've been in any number of lists that are these top 10 and 50 and all of these other kinds of great recognitions that you've received. And I imagine that you could have gone in any number of directions with your career at the point that you're in right now. What made you take the risk and move into startup world?
Well, it was a dimension of my resume that I hadn't checked off yet. It's not for the faint of heart, and I knew that. You know, I'd spent my time in both, you know, in large companies, but also in companies that were medium-sized when I started and grew to be very large while I was there. So I really love the idea of high growth. I always worked in sort of the entrepreneurial part of larger organizations. So whether I was launching the direct-to-consumer business for Limited 2 or joining Ralph Lauren less than a year after they launched their website and e-commerce business and growing that business to a formidable business. I joined Tory Burch when it was a couple hundred million dollar business and it grew to over a billion while I was there.
So, but a lot of the women that listen to this show are, you know, in a position where they're trying to make decisions about what they're going to do next. And I'm wondering, for you, are there things that you've kind of kept in mind as you've gone through your different career choices that have helped you make good decisions?
Yeah.
Like, how do you evaluate new opportunities as they come along?
Well, let me back up a little bit, because just to answer your prior question. So there was this theme of high growth that I loved in my career. I have had two pretty significant experiences dealing with children, marketing to children. So whether it was that was at Limited 2 or at Ralph Lauren, where we had a very sizable children's business. So I was always drawn back to that. And then I met Chaim Daba, our founder, about a year before I joined the company. And it was when he was launching the company, hiring employee number one. And he was launching the search for his CEO because he never intended to run it day to day. He just wanted to be founder and chairman. And now we call him entrepreneur in residence because he's started so many companies and successfully exited them. So I was drawn to him, too, and his leadership and his track record and his reputation. So I think finding people that you can rely on, that are going to serve as your support system and that you're going to report into or be supported by as mentors, is really, really important in making decisions in your career. That's been a resounding theme for me. In terms of joining Kidbox, I saw it as an opportunity to do something new, start up a business, enjoy that high growth, year over year high growth, come into work every day understanding that there's a new problem, looking at your schedule, thinking that you know how your day is going to go, and then your day goes completely differently because every day is different, which is exciting to me. I'm one to exponentially move forward every day. I like to make significant things happen, and when I'm just in a maintain mode, I find myself getting a little bored. That's been a theme in my career as well. So, and then the social mission for Kidbox definitely drew me to it. But I would say the number one thing, the thing that I just kept coming back to when I was comparing it to other opportunities, was this ability as a leader that's been at the executive level for several years now, over a decade, and the opportunity to build a culture, to hire the people I want to hire, to create the team I want to create, to empower people, to set the guidelines and the rules of how we're going to behave, how we're going to show up, what Kidbox culture is, was really exciting to me. So, and it was exciting for Chaim too, because I think a lot of companies start up and they don't hire a seasoned leader until they're maybe past their Series B or Series C funding. Mm-hmm. And by then you have 60, 100, 150 employees, and a culture may already be in place. And it's hard to re-engineer a culture once it's in place. So culture is really important, and it's that intangible feeling when you get when you're interviewing with a company or thinking about a new idea for yourself if you want to go into business for yourself. So in terms of making good decisions, it comes down to people, the people you're going to be able to surround yourself with, the people who are hiring you. I think, you know, going with the numbers on the paper and the title on the paper and the way it's going to look on your resume is important to an extent, but having that sort of intangible fire in your belly for, yes, this is such a cool opportunity, this is what I want to do, this is how I want to spend my days, I'm going to have a skip in my step when I walk into work every day, that trumps everything. There's not, you know, of course people want to be successful and they want to be rewarded, and they want to be rewarded commensurate with the contribution that they're making financially or title-wise, position-wise. But that feeling of really loving what you're doing and being passionate about it is of the highest importance in my mind.
Well, it's really interesting. I think, you know, a couple things that you said keep coming back to this idea of the importance of people. And I feel like, especially in Silicon Valley, like a lot of times there's so much credence and emphasis and, you know, attention given to what the idea is. And what you're really saying is that the people are something that you focused on, and that's really led you through your career. So I think that's really, you know, I want listeners to kind of hear that and keep it in mind as they're moving forward with what they're trying to do and build going forward. And then I just love that you brought in the whole piece about having the leadership at the very beginning, because I think we've seen come out in the media, you know, any number of times over the past year, companies that have done really well and grown huge fan bases, but they have gotten to that point where there was a pretty massive team in place and the leadership needed to shift. And it's when those growing pains happen, it's very public. And it sounds like you're putting things in place to get it right from the beginning.
So. And that's really a testament to Chaim. That was his vision. He wanted to get a seasoned person who's grown multiple businesses, has a track record in direct-to-consumer and digital and e-commerce, and he wanted to get that person in early to attract like-minded people, because an idea is only an idea until the people make it happen and take it into whatever direction it's going to evolve into.
Well, speaking of what Kidbox is going to evolve into, if people want to keep up with all the great stuff you guys have coming out this year, what's the best way for them to find you online and connect with the brand?
Certainly have our website, our mobile site, and our app, kidbox.com. We try to keep up with, we're very grateful, but we've been receiving a lot of press. We try to keep up with all the news about our brand on our website and links to those articles and so forth. And we're, you know, just in terms of this podcast, we're currently in the business of sizes 2 to 14. We're launching Baby in another month or so. And that's going to be a whole new business for us, because when you think about Baby, I have two children myself. I didn't buy a lot of my own baby clothes because my family and friends contributed to their wardrobe the first couple years of their life pretty significantly. So it's going to launch us into a new gifting mindset as well, and also hopefully serve as an amazing customer acquisition vehicle for us to carry through that baby's life all the way until they're size 14, 15, 16. So we're differentiated in the marketplace in terms of the fact that we're multi-brand. We have the widest breadth of sizes, and now with Baby, I think that just extends that even more so, and having the social mission at our cause along with our price-value equation, really providing value for the customers, differentiates us so far. But we're happy to see some competition in the marketplace, because it says that there's a demand for this curation of style and apparel for children. So we're excited about it.
Sure, I love the idea of the gifting component, because I feel like that's such a thing that I know from my own experience, people want to give you the gift of clothes, but then it's very hard to actually pick what your child's going to want to wear, and then that the parents are also going to be into, and you know, it seems like you're going to be solving a problem that lots of new moms run into. Do you have a social platform that stands out that you'd want to direct people to more than others?
We're active on Facebook and Instagram, and we're developing our Pinterest strategy right now and working out. My experience at Tory Burch taught me the power of social media. We had a very robust social media strategy. It took time to build it over several years. We're doing the same, not the same strategy, obviously, because it's a completely different brand, but we're definitely looking at social channels to see what makes the most sense. But Facebook is our most robust channel so far, and we're continuing to build on that.
All right, awesome. Well, thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule at Shop Talk to talk to me and the listeners at Spirit of 608, and I hope you have a great rest of your day.
Thank you so much.
Done and done. Phew, that was a lot. That is the first time that we've had four different people interviewed in one episode, but we wanted to keep all of these conversations in this one extra long bonus episode because I wanted to bring a really well-rounded lens on not only what happened at Shop Talk and the fact that I obviously think it's a great event to attend, but you know, the sheer breadth of different perspectives and types of people participating in the future of retail and the future of the fashion industry right now. So I hope this has been helpful to you on a practical level and possibly also helpful as you think about the industry events and networking opportunities that will be coming up for you later this year. As for what's coming up with us later this year, we are growing the show and the listenership by leaps and bounds. Much of that is happening because so many of you are sharing the show, and I want to just say thank you so much for doing that. If you are a regular listener, it helps us out so much when you subscribe, rate, and review the show in iTunes or your favorite podcast player and let others in your world know that they can come to the Spirit of 608 for cool, inspiring, motivating conversations about the future of fashion, retail, and e-commerce. If you're headed to a super cool industry event later this year, I hope you will come and join the Spirit of 608 Facebook group and tell us all about it so maybe we can meet up if we're there too. And you will find a link to do that in the sidebar of the Spirit of 608 blog at spiritof608.com/blog, at spiritof608.com/blog. Last but not least, I hope you will join me next time for another conversation with a woman at the forefront of fashion, entrepreneurship, sustainability, and tech. As you know, I call it FEST, and it's the future.